Today's session of Get Real is with my regular guest, Professor Steve Putney, expert in the Constitution, American history, and with retired attorney Diane Gruber, way out there on the left coast of Washington State. And today we're going to discuss wealth creation and America and how this country was set up to be literally be the land of opportunity, not of equal outcomes, just equal opportunity. And today's session is sponsored by Kaler Wealth Management Group in Lynchburg, Virginia. Do you have some money that you would like to leverage, safeguard, grow? Give us a call, 434-455-7197. Before we get into this, I've been a financial planner for over 51 years. I know what works, and I know what doesn't work. And usually it's attitude. I was recently at a retirement home, and there were perhaps 30 young women who worked there. And I was called in to talk about their 401ks and to talk to them individually, because these girls weren't putting money into their 401k, even though the employer was matching dollar for dollar up to 6%. And so the typical girl was maybe 25 to 35 years old. You're not putting any money into your 401k, and so your employer is not putting in any money either. Did you know if you put a dollar in, they'll put a dollar in as well, and it's all tax-free, and it'll grow tax-deferred until you retire? And she would say, by the way, it's all women. She would say, I have no money to put in my 401k. Oh, do you budget? No. Do you have cable TV? Yes, I do. Do you have any premium channels? Yeah, I have three of them. And how much is that costing you? $350 a month. I said, I'm more than a millionaire, and I don't have cable TV. I have an antenna. And here in Lynchburg, I get 50 stations, TV stations for free. My antenna cost me $40 once. And I have, of course, I have internet, so I have my computer at home. That's $80 a month. And I bought a Roku device, and that was around $25. So I save roughly $250 a month. And if you did the same as I do, and I'll help you do it, let's see what you'll have when you retire. Oh, you'll have $1.8 million in your retirement account. Will you do that? No, I like my TV. I'll tell you what, tonight when you watch your premium movie, that if you waited 3 months, you could see that same movie and have $1.8 million when you retire. Just consider what that movie's costing you. $1.8 million to watch that movie now instead of 3 months from now. And so I came back a week later to interview the same girls who were not putting any money in. And it was not one of them had changed their minds. This goes back to something called delayed gratification. It is the determinant on whether you're going to have wealth or whether you're going to be poor all your life. Delayed gratification. 60 Minutes, some years ago, ran an article on an experiment with little kids. 30 years earlier, six-year-olds were in a room by themselves with the TV camera on. The worker there put five M&Ms in front of the little kid, and they put a clock in front of the kid, and they said, when this hand reaches right here, it was 1 minute. If there are still five M&Ms in front of you, I'm going to come in and put five more down. But if any of them are gone, no, I'm not going to do that. And some of the kids just grabbed their M&Ms right away. Some of them ate one or two. And a lot of them just left them there. And the worker came in and put five down. Then they moved this 30 years forward. Now all the participants weren't little kids. They were 36 years old. Literally, every one of them that could wait until there were five more M&Ms. They were successful in life. The ones who grabbed their M&Ms right away were not successful in life. So I want to start off with Professor Steve Putney here. Why is America a land of opportunity? Not for everyone, because I know as a financial planner what works and what doesn't work. It works with me and it works with my clients. Why are some people wealthy in America, and what causes that as a country?
Well, thank you, George. If we're talking about at the time of the Constitution, let's go back before then, when there was very limited civil oversight or civil government, and people, through their own initiative and by being disciplined, what they worked for was theirs. And the founders, the framers of the Constitution recognized that. They had benefited by that policy of limited government, and they wrote that into the Constitution. It may not be explicit, but it's implicit in the Constitution. And so there's no restraint. You are the beneficiary of what you produce. And people that are disciplined and have initiative and want to succeed and provide for their family were able to do so and did so. But as you move into the 20th century, and that gave rise to liberty. You know, the word liberal in the 19th century meant the maximization of liberty. And as you move into the 20th century, they still used the word liberal, but it took on a new meaning. No longer did it mean more liberty or the maximizing of liberty. It came to mean the maximization of equality of outcome. There's a disincentive in the 20th century, or there was, and still today in the 21st century, to work hard. The harder you work, the more the government's going to take from you now, which was not the case in the 19th century.
Oh, that's a bummer. It's a tragedy. Diane, you've been an attorney for so many years, and you served both wealthy and non-wealthy people during the course of your time. I assume you served non-wealthy people as well. Maybe your rates were so high that nobody could afford you unless they were wealthy. What is your view on how do people gain wealth in America, and why don't, since the rules are pretty much the same for everybody, why are some people poor and dependent on the government?
Oh boy. Well, we entered an era in America in the 60s, I think, with the LBJ's Great Society. I forget the terminology, but it was planned idleness, that we were trained to be idle and sit around and wait for the government to hand us whatever they were going to hand us. I watched the work ethic. When I was growing up and even into the 60s or so, one of the compliments you could give somebody was they worked hard. They had a strong work ethic. They took care of themselves and their families. And this was true even for housewives. I mean, they didn't bring in any money, but they were working to provide for their family, fixing the meals and making a nice home and so forth. People went to great lengths. People who desperately needed some type of assistance from the government would refuse it because it hurt their pride. And early on when the food stamps were introduced in the 60s, people that needed it to feed their families would not go to the local grocery store where their neighbors and the clerks knew them and would see them using the food stamps. They would go to another neighborhood where they were a stranger because they were embarrassed. Well, fast forward. Doesn't that sound quaint now? People with their food stamp card, it's an electronic benefit transfer card, they brag about it. They strut in there and they brag about it. Some of them even laugh at the people that are buying their own groceries with their own money. So I don't know if I answered your questions. I think I got off on a tangent there, George. But the whole
like
concept of working for yourself is really, really, it's providing for yourself and the pride you have and the dignity has been wiped out.
I was in a grocery store not too long ago. A man came up to me. For the sake of the story, I have to tell you, he was black. And he looked at my grocery cart and he said, "I notice you have some canned vegetables and bread and milk and a few other things in your grocery cart." And I said, "Yeah, I do." He said, "Could I pay for them?" I said, "No, I pay for my own stuff." He said, "No, I want to pay for them. And then you pay for mine with your cash. I'll pay for yours with my card." Yeah, he had, it wasn't food stamps. It was a credit card. And it looks just like anybody's credit cards. And they did that to release the stigma of using credit cards.
Yeah, but it was welfare. It wasn't his money.
It wasn't his. And I said, "Wait a second. I'm going to pay cash for your cigarettes and for your beer, and you're going to buy my groceries." I said, "You are cheating the system, and you're going to destroy the system by doing it." Yeah. I said, "No, I'm not going to do that for you." And he called me a bad racist name, if honky is a bad name. I'm a jive honky because I wouldn't do that for him. But it struck me that it was his entitlement to buy the beer and cigarettes at somebody else's expense. And the rules were wrong because they did so. The other day on Facebook, someone put a meme on there. It said, "Instead of telling me I should cut down on my lattes and premium TV channels, maybe they could cut down on their mansions and yachts and pay me a decent income." And I had to comment on that. I knew I would get a lot of flack, but I commented. I said, "Rich people will always act like rich people. You cannot control the way they think, but you can control the way you think. And you don't need to buy your lattes in your premium channels." Getting back to premium channel, it just makes me crazy. And the iPhones and the iWatches, or whatever they're called, Apple Watches, they're expensive. And you see kids with them now. It's like everybody has to have something, and they have to have it right now. Steve.
You know, there was as you're talking, I'm thinking of a book called The Unheavenly City, written, I think, in the 1960s or early 70s. I'm not exactly sure, copyright. Banfield, I think, was the author's last name. I can't think of his first name right off. Taught sociology at the University of Chicago. In that book, what he talks about is the different socioeconomic levels in culture. And his conclusion is that it's not based on your income, it's based on your time horizon. He said rich people are not thinking of today, they're thinking of the next generation. The middle class, they don't think of today. They think maybe from year to year. This is what we want to be able to do in a year. This is what we want to be able to do in 5 years. And so they plan accordingly. Working class, they're thinking paycheck to paycheck. The poor, they're thinking, what can I do right now? What can I get right now with my money? So he says it's based on time horizon, which I think has a lot to do with a person's maturity. You're talking about the six-year-olds that could wait 60 seconds before they ate their five M&Ms. They had a degree of maturity, remarkably, for a six-year-old. You know, you can anticipate or expect immaturity out of children, but at some point you're going to have to gain some maturity. You can't live immature your entire life. That is, unless you do expect someone else to take care of you.
Well, George, you were asking me about my clients.
Yes.
I saw a wide range of this, where people, and I had clients all the way from welfare mothers to trust fund babies and everywhere in between, and all races, and I had immigrants, and you know, I had the, you know, because I was just a practitioner out there dealing with normal people, okay, family law, bankruptcy, probate, and so forth. It's true, just what you said, Steve. One of the things that I noticed was paycheck to paycheck attitude, and this had nothing to do with how much they were getting in their paycheck. I mean, I had people making, you know, like pushing $200,000 a year that could barely put food on the table because they had to run up their debts. They had to service all their credit card debts. And, you know, people with, we used to get a laugh at my office when we did bankruptcies because me and my secretary and my law clerk, we would always take note of the car that the bankruptcy client was driving when they arrived at the first time at our office. And almost without fail, they always had a brand new car. They had cars better than us, you know, me and my staff had newer cars and more expensive cars. But of course, they're mortgaged up to the hilt. The car is not owned free and clear. And another thing I noticed too was people would own more cars than they had drivers in the household, and all those cars or trucks or whatever were also on loan. It was just an attitude. Got to have it now, now, now. Even when your paycheck says no, 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 and they always blame somebody else. That's an interesting phenomenon I noticed, not just in bankruptcy, but in family law. As long as the person in their mind convinced themselves, before they arrived at my office, had convinced themselves that their problem that they were in was somebody else's fault, then they never had to deal with correcting that problem. And that was something I've noticed, an attitude I noticed with so many people. And of course, that attitude's going to trap them having that same problem over and over and over again because they're not taking responsibility for the situation they got themselves into because they've got somebody else to blame. You know, and I'm dealing with adults, so I'm not about to lecture them. But I mean, this was just something that I saw.
That makes me think of a story. You know, my wife used to work in a bank. Actually, I did for a short time. But she had worked her way up the ranks. But anyway, the owner of the bank was an elderly gentleman that had never married, but he knew how to make money. And he didn't work well with the public, though. And here's, I'll give you an example why. Because there was a couple came in and they wanted to borrow some money. And this was, I don't know, November, it was in the fall. And he says, well, what are you wanting it for? Well, we want to start buying Christmas gifts for our family. He says, Christmas gifts? Didn't you know Christmas was coming? Sherry was smooth. She could work with people, but I mean, yeah, it's coming. Yeah.
There used to be a thing called the Christmas clubs in banks, and you would put some money aside every month. So in December, you were going to spend $100 on Christmas presents altogether. And by that time, you'd have $100 in there. Right. I had a secretary about 30 years ago, and I said, I'll tell you what, I am going to put $100 a month into your child's college fund. It's called the 529 plan. It's in Virginia here. The money grows tax-free, and it comes out tax-free if it's used for college. I said, now, Mary, I'm going to be doing this, but if you touch any of the money ever, I'm going to stop doing that. And she said, how long are you going to do that? I said, every month. She said, well, what if I quit working? I said, this is about your child, not about you. Yeah, I'll put it in $100 a month until your kid's in college, unless you touch the money. A year and a half later, Christmas came around, and she took money out for Christmas presents. Oh. And I stopped doing it. And she was very angry at me. She said, I needed money for Christmas presents. I said, the rules are the rules. I'm not going to do this for you anymore. And then I had to fire her because she was caught shoplifting. It was like the ultimate, I must have this, I will do this. And she forfeited her child's college fund. Now, I didn't take any of it back, but she eventually, I noticed in the account that she took all the money out. And I don't know what it was for, but once again, no delayed gratification. That is the story right there. I had a doctor some years ago, he came to see me. And he was in really bad financial shape. And I was looking at his credit cards and this and that. And I said, I notice you still belong to the Boonesboro Country Club. It's an expensive country club here in Virginia. I said, but you're not paying your mortgage. He said, well, my friends will know instantly if I'm not paying my dues at the country club. But they won't know instantly if I'm not paying my mortgage.
Right.
So there we have something called saving face. You can't save face forever.
Well, and it's keeping up with the Joneses, too. It sounds to me like he is keeping up with wealthy Joneses that are too wealthy for his blood.
That could be pretty bad. I want to go back to our historian here, Steve Putney. And we were talking earlier about self-reliance and the pride of making it on your own. Did that come from the Bible? Where did that come from anyway?
Yes, it does. And in terms of Western culture, and if you've ever wondered why is the West wealthy in respect to other cultures in the world, it's because of the undergirding, the foundation of the Christian faith. Especially, and let's look at the timing of this. Around 1500, you have the Reformation, and you think of Nehemiah, the book of Nehemiah in the Old Testament, where people had a mind to work, and work was identified as a form of worship. That's where the Puritans' thought form was when they came to North America, and they took this land. And think of Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, where God told Adam and Eve to be fruitful, multiply, subdue the earth. That was the mindset of people that established North America and then the United States. They had a mind to work. Protestantism and the work ethic, it was written in the early 20th century, and I'm sorry that the author's name slips my mind at the moment, but he talks about what began as the Protestant work ethic came to be known by the time he's writing as the American work ethic. And if we fast forward another 100 years today, even that has been lost. And I think it's partly lost because of a disincentive that's been established in the graduated income tax system. You know, I had a good friend in Ohio. I remember he was an eighth grade graduate, but he was a millionaire and he could expand his business. He tried to set me up in a store one time with the product that he sold. And he said, Steve, he said, there's really no incentive for me to expand because the more I make, the more the government takes.
Oh, and another thing I learned from my clients early on, how to work the system. I learned from them, you know, and these people were smart enough to figure all this out, but they did not want to put that intellectual energy into furthering themselves in a career. There's so many welfare programs, and there, because they're state, they're federal, they're even county and city welfare. There's so many ways that somebody that really focuses, well, basically scam the system. Like one of the examples, I'll just give you one of the examples. The earned income tax credit, which of course is a form of welfare because you're getting money from the taxpayers that you never earned, but you did work part-time. About November or so, these people, earned income tax credit people, didn't want to work anymore. They'd say, take me off the schedule until January. And they had calculated to the dollar how much they could make so that they could get the maximum earned income tax credit. And once they made past that amount, then the earned income tax credit would be slowly eaten away and eaten down. So they had calculated all this in advance and come about, you know, October, November, they didn't want to work anymore because they wanted to suck off the earned income tax credit. And when that was expanded, the earned income tax credit has been around, I believe, since the 70s, but it was expanded greatly under Clinton. I noticed it right away in my practice because what would happen was April 15th was no longer the tax date for these people. These people were filing in February. So CPA started doing most of their work in February because these people wanted their earned income tax credit. And so they would hound the employer to give them their W-2 as quick as possible. So employers even changed their behavior. The IRS requires an employer to issue the 1099 by January 31st. Well, that went out the window because the employers were tired of getting harassed. So they started, as soon as the calculations were done by the payroll office, the W-2 was issued the first week in January, second week in January, so that they could rush out and get their welfare money. I mean, that's just one example of how to work the system.
One of the most egregious examples of how America has set up the disincentive, on September 11, 2001, when our trade towers were attacked, people there that had been killed, their families received money from the government, anywhere from $500,000 to $10 million for each person who had been killed. Now, as far as I'm concerned, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Why should we pay $500,000 to $10 million? A Puerto Rican busboy who hadn't learned English yet, his family would get $500,000. A doctor who was, let's say, 40 years old, had a family, his family could get up to $10 million. However, let's say the doctor had $1 million in his 401k, and he had $3 million of life insurance and $200,000 in savings. The life insurance, the 401k, and the savings would be deducted from the $10 million. Absolutely, that's the rules. People there who had done well, they had insured their lives so their families would be okay. They were saving money for the retirement. They were penalized. The ones who had done nothing, their families got full awards for their loved one being killed. Now, it was a tragedy. Maybe America was just, at the time, maybe they were just trying to put a Band-Aid on the wound by doing that. But the way they did that was such a disincentive to buy life insurance, to save up for your future, to care about your family.
Two things come to my mind as you're talking about that, George. One, I could be very generous with your money, and that's exactly what government is doing. It's being generous with the taxpayers' dollar. And the second thing that comes to mind is that this whole notion, this whole idea of we're going to grant you $10 million because of this tragedy that occurred, but because you have $3.2 million, as you described in your illustration there, we're going to deduct that amount from the $10 million. That reminds me, Karl Marx.
From each according to his ability, each according to his need.
Were you aware that when all this largesse was given out to the, you know, the 9/11 victims' families, the people who had suffered, October of 2000, there was the bombing of the USS Cole. And then in 1998, there were bombings of two group of jihadists had done all this. They'd done the 9/11, they'd done the Cole, and the ones in 1998 under Clinton. And the people from those that were left over, the injured people plus families of the deceased, they were petitioning, demanding, advocating. They were jealous because they hadn't gotten the money that these people were getting. I can see their point. Once you start passing out money willy-nilly for I would say no reason, unearned money from the taxpayers, then it's kind of got a snowball effect, doesn't it?
Where does it end? Well,
yeah.
Speaking of where does it end?
Uh-oh.
I'm afraid we're going to have to end this right now. Thank you, Professor Steve Putney. Thank you for Attorney Diane Gruber for being with me today. Thank you so much for Alberto, our technician here, who's so faithful. You're getting married, aren't you, coming up here, Alberto? He's marrying the granddaughter of my secretary, and I couldn't be happier for her. Alberto is such a wonderful guy, and he's a bass player, which makes him even more lovable. So, everybody, thank you so much for listening to Get Real. Please tell your friends. Go to teawithgeorge.com, Get Real. Send the link to your friends in other states where they're not getting this radio program. To everyone out there, may God bless your day.